I came across a footnote that said that a man named Shoe Boots married a black woman, and this was the first black Cherokee marriage within the Cherokee Nation. So that footnote really struck me, the idea that there would be a marriage between a Cherokee man and a black woman that was recorded in the early 1800s. So I wanted
And he was a wealthy Cherokee man, right?
I would say that in our terms, he was middle class.
Oh, okay.
So he was solid financially, but he wasn't one of the wealthiest Cherokee slaveholders who owned something like 20 or more slaves, and in some cases, 100 or more slaves. Okay. He only had a handful of slaves. Only, I say. Yeah. So I wanted to investigate the story and find out what was going on. And as I began to investigate, I learned that that footnote left out so much. And in my mind, this relationship was not what we would describe today as a marriage. Yeah. This was a relationship between a grown man in his 40s who went to South Carolina and either bought or traded for an adolescent black girl, brought her back to the Cherokee Nation, and began to have children with her. Dahl was owned by Shoe Boots, and he never freed her formally.
I mean, there's that. There was a piece of writing that's near the beginning of the book. I think it was Shoe Boots maybe making a case for his children.
Yes.
Right? And he, mm-hmm. But what's so striking and painful about that is he's making a case for these children he's had by Dahl. Mm-hmm. And he basically says, I debased myself.
Exactly.
You know,
yes.
And had these children, and nevertheless, then he's wanting them to be treated decently.
Right, right. I mean, this is one of these moments where the pain that we were discussing earlier really is seated. Because on the one hand, we can view this emancipation document as being positive. It's an example of a Native American man freeing the children that he had with a black woman. But at the same time, he does that through a language of negativity,
yeah.
in which he reiterates Dahl's status as a slave woman. And in the original document, it's underlined that she is his slave. Shoe Boots and Dahl would have lived in the early 1800s, 45 minutes away, you know, now in our time, from this large plantation. I mean, Shoe Boots and Dahl's cabin, the place where their family lived, no longer stands. But I wanted to experience a built environment that could perhaps take me back in time viscerally to this period of Cherokee slaveholding. So I went to the chief van house and took a tour. And part of me was taken by learning about the house itself, the structure, the architecture. I was fascinated by a number of the architectural details, such as all of the little tiny Cherokee roses that are carved into the moldings at the house. Mm. But at the same time, I was quite focused on the question of slavery. And throughout that whole tour, we heard nothing about slavery, now, nothing about
Did African you know Americans. That he specifically held slaves, or did you just knew that a landowner of that wealth in that time would have had slaves?
I knew that he held slaves because at that point I had been doing enough research to know about the Van family.
Okay.
So I took the tour and slavery wasn't mentioned. African Americans weren't mentioned, although the Van family's wealth was mentioned. Hmm. And of course, these two things are tied. They're linked. You can't separate them.
What did you do? Did you say anything at that point to the people who were curating? Or
I did. I asked a question. Mm-hmm. I asked the tour guide where slaves lived on the plantation. And the person who was working at the time, I have to be fair and say that she was, you know, very young. Maybe she was a college student who was working there at the summer, you know, part-time. She was completely flustered, as if she had never thought about the question before. Never heard it before. And she got her walkie-talkie and radioed back to the main office to ask how she should answer the question. Hmm. When I first arrived at the Chief Van House site and then kept coming back to do research there, I think there was a little bit of distance on the part of the people who worked at the site. And these were white Southerners. These are white Southerners mm-hmm. who work at the site still. There was some distance there. But what I found was that over time, when I kept showing up, we found ways to connect with each other. So, for instance, I learned after probably 5 years of going to the site that one of the rangers at the site who had a good deal of input on the interpretation there was herself descended from white slaveholders. Mm-hmm. And when she told me this, and I have her permission to repeat the story, when she told me this, it was a revelation that brought her to tears, that she had been holding back from interpreting Black experience in this Cherokee site because of the shame of her own family's history.
Right.
When we talked about that and we kind of pushed through that together, she became the greatest champion for African-American interpretation at the site. I mean, she applied for funding. She researched and actually mounted an exhibit that's all about African-American experience at the Chief Band House. But it took that relational foundation, that collaboration, to make it happen.
That's Taya Miles. Hear my interview with her in our upcoming show, Toward Living Memory, at onbeing.org.